I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Hello there, Greenhorns. This is Severin again with another episode of Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. Today I'm joined on the phone by Karen Williams from Red Dog Farm in Chimacum. How do I say that?
Chimacum.
Chimacum, Washington. And she is an organic farmer, and her name is her dog. Her farm is named for her dog. How is your farm doing, and how is your dog doing this morning?
Oh, they're both doing well. It's really wet and rainy over here, so we're a little soggy, but everyone's good.
So, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about today is marketing. But maybe we should start with just an introduction of yourself and your farm operation and what you particularly pride yourselves on.
Sure. I've been farming for about the last 14 years, and I've been at Red Dog. I started Red Dog a little over 3 years ago, and the farm is certified organic. It's 23 acres total, and we're currently at about 13 acres in cultivation. We grow mixed vegetables, berries, cut flowers, and we also do plant starts. What do we pride ourselves on? Just a really good variety of produce, top quality, of course. I like to do all my marketing locally, so we mostly just local, distribute to Olympic Peninsula, which is the larger area that we're in. And I guess that's about it.
So you're doing a lot of direct marketing, and on your scale, that means that you're meeting a lot of your consumers. Would you mind just giving us a little primer on, for those of us who are just getting started in farming and who are working to finesse our market etiquette, some of the things that you've found in terms of presentation, good manners, and the kind of attitude to take when you're face-to-face selling your produce?
Sure. I market through a couple different avenues. I do farmers markets, and this year we're doing three local farmers markets. We also have a CSA program, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and that's a subscription program where customers sign up at the beginning of the season and get a box of produce every week for the whole season. And then we have a on-site farm stand. I also sell to several area restaurants and to some local retailers as well. Like, there's a pretty large food co-op in Port Townsend. I sell to them. And as far as, what's worked well for me, definitely diversifying my marketing strategy, having all those different outlets. Sometimes, of course, there's crop failures. Sometimes, a restaurant may be slower than they thought they would be, or sales may be slower at a certain market. So it's really nice to be able to bounce the produce between all the different markets and kind of just not have my eggs all in one basket. That's been really helpful. And then as far as face-to-face, just being really upfront about people, about what I am capable of and what I'm not, just knowing my limitations are. I've learned to, start small and just grow a little bit gradually every year. And I'm definitely ambitious and try to do a little bit more every year, but I try not to overextend myself. And I really make an effort not to tell someone that I can do something that I'm not, 95% sure that I actually can pull off. In a market setting, just being really friendly and, just kind of that basic stuff, being friendly, being open, sharing ideas about what you cooked for dinner last night, having really good presentation, having the product actually look really fresh and the display really nice. Having the same person at market every week can be really helpful. So those are some ideas off the top of my head anyway.
And so you say that you've been farming for 14 years, but then only in the last three have you been running your own operation. Maybe you could, again, just summarize the different stages of your farming life so that people who are, you know, dreaming their farm dream can get a sense of, you know, one particular path into ag and what that took.
Sure. Well, I've been running my own farm for 6 years. It's only been 3 years at this last farm, but I'll start from the beginning. So in 1998, I went to Europe for an extended stay. I stayed for 2 years, and I was woofing around on different organic farms over there. And then for the last year, I actually ended up finding a farm to work at and stayed at that one farm for a year. So that was my first introduction to farming. I had grown up in the suburbs of Seattle. I had, you know, not even had a vegetable garden. It was all new to me, and the rural lifestyle and living off the land was completely new. And so that was a really eye-opening experience, and I completely loved it. From there, I decided that I wanted to finish my degree, and so I went to the Evergreen State College in Olympia, and I did finish my degree. I did their sustainable agriculture program, and also worked, they have an organic farm at Evergreen State College, and I worked on the farm for the whole time that I was a student, as well as a couple years afterwards, and just learned a whole bunch through that process. I can't say enough about going to school and just getting down the basics of farming. You know, that includes the actual science of farming, horticulture, biology, botany kind of practice, as well as soil science, and then most importantly, if you can find a school that has bookkeeping, farm management, production management, accounting, anything like that is really, really helpful. And then next in my path, then, when I was sort of ready to move on from working at Evergreen, I found a farm for lease up in the same area that I'm at now, a small farm called Old Harbu Farm, and it was a really great next step for me. It was a farm that was had been run as an organic farm previously, and there were some new owners that had just bought it from. The previous owners were farmers, and the new owners bought it sort of as an investment property, but they wanted someone to farm it. And it was great for me to walk into. There was, you know, the fields were set up, the irrigation was in place, there was a greenhouse, there was a barn, there was a tractor I could use. And so I was able to have my own business at that place and sort of go through the process of having that responsibility, and I had to take out some loans. And, you know, having complete responsibility as a business owner, but not having to have to purchase all the infrastructure up front. And, again, I would totally recommend that to anyone who wanted to get into farming, is find some kind of middle ground between working on a farm and actually owning your own farm, and just so you can just try it out and not have all that burden. And then I was at Old Harbu Farm for 2 years. And then I took a year off from a serious farm commitment, and I kind of wandered around a little bit. I did some traveling. I worked on some different farms, you know, all over the West Coast, and I was also looking for farmland to buy. And I found this piece of land that I'm on now, and I had a lot of help from the community here to purchase this piece of land, particularly from the Jefferson Land Trust in Port Townsend. They are a wonderful organization. I know there's a lot of land trusts across the country, but if anyone is thinking of buying land, it's definitely a good resource to talk with those people. And so I was able to get on this piece of land, and I've been here since late 1997 and have just been in the process over the last 3 years of putting in infrastructure. This land was just a raw piece of land when I bought it, so I put in, you know, a barn and irrigation and septic and greenhouses and driveway and electric, and I mean, just, you know, all the kind of really basic stuff. And it's been really fun. It's been, you know, really, really challenging. It's really a lot of work to build a farm up from scratch. It's very rewarding, but it's something that I'm really glad that I had a lot of experience under my belt, and I've worked in a lot of different farms before I undertook that, so I could really see all the systems that other farms use and kind of pick and choose which ones were going to work for me, and just have all the experience before I got started and kind of creating this new project.
Yeah, what you're saying about that in-between time, I feel like that speaks a lot to me. That's where I am in my farm career, but also it seems like that's sometimes a challenge to feel comfortable with yet another management position when you're kind of jonesing for your own thing. And so it's nice to hear you on the other side of that decision feeling really positive about taking the time to kind of go to farmer grad school and,
yeah.
and have to be accountable.
No, I hear you. And when I was in that place, it was really challenging to work with landlords who sometimes have different goals for the land than I would have for it if I owned it, and just to kind of to have that connection to the land but not be totally responsible for. Sometimes that was really challenging because, you know, I wanted to have that responsibility. I just wasn't ready for it yet and didn't know it. So it's a hard place to be in, but I think it's looking back, it was really, really important. So.
Well, and there certainly are, I think, increasing numbers, just from my own experience talking about young farmer stuff, and I've been in farm conference mode for a while, and, you know, landowner or prospective farmland owners just coming up to me left and right saying, hey, you know, I'm thinking about making an investment in some farmland. I'd really like to make a partnership with a young farmer and set up a business and help them out with infrastructure. So I feel like there's going to be more and more opportunity in that mm-hmm. place, and I think it's up to us as young farmers to really make sure that you work that opportunity in a positive way and don't get too bummed out by the fact that they misunderstand a lot of things about farming and
yes,
use it as
exactly.
a stepping stone.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that's a little commentary, but maybe will you talk about you're saying that you built your farm up from scratch,
mm-hmm.
and that you know, is often more challenging than restoring a farm. What's so great about having the power to design it all?
Could you say the last part again? I couldn't hear you very well.
Oh, sorry. The last part was maybe just comment on when you build your own farm from scratch, mm-hmm. It's very expensive, but you do get the opportunity to really design the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's worth it in terms of the cost or not.
Hmm.
Like, if somebody was thinking about starting with blank land, would you counsel them to do that or not?
I think I would say if you can find land that has already been developed in you know, at least partially, if not completely the way you want it, I mean, I think it'd be cheaper in the long run to do that. And, you know, you have to live with other people's mistakes or other people doing things maybe the way that you wouldn't have liked them, but I think it'd be worth it. You know, I would have much rather have bought land that, you know, had already at least had, you know, septic, electric, water on it. And, you know, it would have been great to buy land that already has structure on it, so I wouldn't have to have built a structure right away. I don't think I would recommend buying raw land. Yeah, it's doable, and it's nice because you can set things up how you want, but you also have to have the money to do that, and everything is so expensive, and what I've had to do is just a little bit every year, and, you know, it's just stepping stones every year. I'd say go for a land that it already had some infrastructure on it and already had some amenities, basically.
So you had no infrastructure, and the land that you got, was it already in good condition? Had it been in, what was it, in hay, or was it in vegetables already?
Yeah, it was in excellent condition. It had been in hay for the last 10 years. It was part of a dairy farm that it still exists to the north of me, and they had just subdivided off part of it just in order to make some money. And so it had been just hay for the last several years. They hadn't sprayed anything on it. And it was, you know, just this an open field. Literally, it hadn't been worked up, so I had to plow it and prepare the fields for vegetable growing. But as far as the soil, it's beautiful soil.
And you have beautiful soil and you have beautiful farm crew. I'm looking at them on your website right now.
Oh, great! yeah.
And you have such beautiful flowers. I wonder if you could talk a little bit, especially as a woman farmer, I am so attracted to growing cut flowers, and I do grow cut flowers, but I find it's quite a trick to get that part of the business to really yield as much as it needs to pay for all the time involved.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just talk about, you know, what percentage of your business is flowers and how you feel about it, and does it pay for itself, or is it just something that adds to your stand, or how do you feel about flowers?
Yeah, I also love growing flowers. I can't really imagine growing vegetables without growing flowers. As far as my business, it's a very, very small percentage of my business. If I had to guess, I'd say probably maybe 2%, something like that. So it's really small. But I do feel like it does pay for itself. I don't grow a huge variety of flowers. I think I grow maybe 15 different kinds of flowers and then maybe 20 different if you count the dahlias, I grow a lot of different dahlias, but if you don't count the dahlias, I maybe grow 20 different varieties and then add another 15 varieties for the dahlias. So I don't have this huge variety of flowers, but I do try and, you know, always have some flowers from about July through October. And I like them mostly for the, if you count the tulips, we have tulips in April, so that's kind of the early flowers. And I like to have them just mostly for the market display, just to really draw people in. My strategy has been to do bulk flowers. I just cut buckets of one kind of flower in each bucket and bring just the stems to market and let people make their own bouquets, or sometimes I'll make bouquets for people. And I found this to be really successful, and I just do a stem price and like $10 for $4 kind of price. And it's just been really good to kind of draw people in and definitely add some income to the farm. But just doing the cut stems, it doesn't add a lot of labor because we're not taking time to make bouquets. And let's see what else. You know, and of course, you know, everyone knows that flowers attract beneficial insects, and so they bring that to the farm. They also kind of give the soil a break because most flowers don't require a lot of nutrients and aren't really heavy feeders. So they're kind of a good crop to mix in with a vegetable system and just kind of, you know, to rotate through. Yeah, I love growing them. I wouldn't stop growing them, but I feel like they do pay their way.
That's good to hear. I'm excited because I want to keep growing flowers, and I want to figure out. Mm-hmm. I like this making other people do the bouquets. So I was reading through some old little pamphlets that were prepared by ladies' clubs. And it was in a Grange Hall that they would meet and have flower arranging classes together or kind of flower arranging sessions.
Oh, cool.
And it's one of those home arts things that seems to have fallen away. Okay, so the next question I have for you is about this crew of folks that you're farming with. And just a little bit, a sense of the kinds of people who are choosing to become farmers. If you find like there's more demand now than there used to be, or if you think that it's kind of the same, or how the scene is changing, who's joining your farm and where are they coming from?
I've been blessed to just constantly have really good crew members on the farm. People in the past have come from all over the country to work here. You know, it varies from year to year. Some years we get a lot more locals, and some years I get people who are moving to this area particularly to work on the farm. In general, the people who apply for jobs here are pretty well educated. They're usually college graduates, sometimes in the first or second year after they've graduated. Sometimes they maybe have started a career for a couple years, even 5 or 10 years, and then have decided they want to do something else and are kind of looking for their next career, or maybe taking a break and just kind of exploring. You know, we usually get, you know, people that just have really good attitude, are fun to be around, or know what hard work is. And I guess that's a part of it, too. Mostly people want the hard work. Some of them have, you know, maybe worked more office-type jobs and want a break from that, or some of them maybe have always kind of been drawn to more physical labor. But that's definitely a commonality with everyone that works here. Let's see. Not sure what else to say about that.
Well, where do they come to you from all over. They're coming with those kinds of educated backgrounds, good attitude, ready to work hard. And then where do they go next?
Some of them go on to work at different farms. Some of them decide to go back to school. This last year, actually, two farm crew decided to go to grad school after this experience, after many years of not being in school. Some of them go on to other types of jobs. Some of them decide farming isn't for them. You know, one season was enough and it was fun, but that was hard work, and they want to do something else. You know, a whole mix. And some people do stay on sometimes for 2 or 3 years. Just a wide variety. I haven't yet experienced someone that worked for me who started their own farm. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, in the next 5 years that I see that, and I look forward to that. That would be really rewarding for me to see that. But, yeah, that hasn't happened yet. And I think that's just, you know, most of the time when people come to work here, it's their first, second, maybe even their third year working on a farm. And so I think it's, you know, early on in their process of farming generally.
So you're attracting the early birds, and then they have, what time will tell if they keep with it.
Yes, exactly.
But probably for the early birds, it's great to see you in your farm infrastructure development, and like this here beautiful hoop house that I see you guys building. That is a wonderful thing when you're a new farmer. To, you know, it's great when you walk into a farm that has got all its systems dialed in, and there's 50 years of fabulous things that have all been figured out and organized. But setting up new infrastructure is such a valuable learning experience and such a great reason to do your apprenticing with a younger farm. Mm-hmm. Will you talk about how that hoop house project evolved?
The hoop house project, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. The hoop house, we built 2 hoop houses last year. Is that what you're referring to?
That's what I'm looking at, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think it is really empowering for the crew to see the infrastructure being created and to see, yeah, exactly, and to see that that you can, you know, as a young person, you can do these things, and it's not, you don't just have to walk into an already set up system. Like, you can just kind of plug away at it and do little by little, and you can do without for a long time and kind of do a lot with very minimal infrastructure and tools, and, you know, not everything perfectly how you would dream for it to be. So I think that's really valuable for especially young people to see that, young farmers. And, yeah, the hoop house project, last winter we built two hoop houses. They're 20 feet by 95 feet steel frame hoop houses, and it was quite a process. It was my first time building a hoop house from start to finish as well, and, you know, we set it all up and leveled it to make sure it was all really level and even, and dug holes for all the posts and poured concrete and anchored the posts, and then just tied it all together, tied all the hoops together, a lot of screwing into metal overhead. It was pretty challenging work. And then building the ends with lumber and the doors, and then finally putting on the film. And the whole process, I think, took, if we could have done it all just in a short period of time, we could have done them both in probably a week. But, you know, we did half a day here and a couple hours there, and the weather kind of dictated different things. But there were about, you know, regularly, I think there were about 3 or 4 people involved in that whole process. And then for some of the projects, like putting on the plastic, we brought in some other help. Some volunteers came to help us get that on before the wind picked up. But it was a great process, and really fun to be a part of, and really fun to do with other people.
Yeah, and beautiful, beautiful shape. Okay, well, this is really great, and I'm thankful so much for your time and insight, and I wonder if you have any favorite words of guidance or favorite books or thoughts on getting a good start on this season. It's now March. And I'm getting still a lot of people emailing saying, oh, I want to find a farm apprenticeship for this year. Would you maybe give them a gentle scold for not thinking about it until March?
You know, I do have all my crew hired, so I think it's the late. If you've waited this late, it's hard. But there's always farms where the crew is all set to go, and then someone drops out. Someone calls and said they can't do it. And so I've known a couple people that have not necessarily my farm, but on other farms, that they found the best people because someone who had committed in February dropped out, and then someone just showed up in March, and it was a perfect fit. So I think don't give up hope if you don't have your farm yet, and, you know, just keep following what interests you, and keep asking questions, and just keep having fun with it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been another episode of Greenhorns Radio. I thank you all for your work and for your time, and I hope it's a good season.
Thank you, Severine.
Following is a public service announcement from Beer Sessions Radio. Beyond the human and environmental casualties of the triple threat disaster in Japan, there will likely also be losses to our collective food culture, from miso and sake makers to outstanding fisheries. With help from the New York State Brewers Association, the Good Beer Seal, Beer Sessions Radio, and craft breweries alike, Jimmy Carboni is hoping to raise funds that will go directly to Hitachino, an excellent Japanese brewery, through a benefit at Brooklyn Brewery next Monday, March 28th, from 7 to 10 p.m. In addition to beer, there'll be food from the Meat Hook, Jimmy's No. 43, Waterfront Ale House, and a few local Japanese restaurants. All money raised will go to Kyuchi Brewery and Hitachino Beers, which they will distribute via humanitarian aid locally. To date, the brewery, which lost 500 bottles in the earthquake and suffered some damage to its physical plant, is filtering and bottling water for its community and providing them with food. You can read a letter about the quake's aftermath to Jimmy from Toshiyuki Kyuchi, the brewery owner, on his site, and you can buy tickets to the benefit on brownpapertickets.com/event/166978. That's brownpapertickets.com/event/166978. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of Be Our Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.